We just finished the second cohort of the assessment course. And it was a great group. Had people coming from all over the world to learn this stuff. And in response to some of the things that people are struggling with, we wanted to talk about measuring infrasternal angle. So a lot of people have measured themselves or met a lot of people, right. And then they second guess it because they get measured by you or by someone else and they just can't figure it out. And then all of a sudden they thought they were wide for the last 3 years. And now They're like, oh, I'm actually a very compressed and narrow.
Yeah.
So I think we should address that a little bit.
Yeah.
And then underlying theme of all this being no single measurement matters that much. So even if you were to get it wrong And choose a narrow pathway as for in your interventions and programming, It doesn't necessarily mean that all will be lost.
Right. One of the things that people need to recognize that as you get better and better at measuring anything, there's an experiential element to it, and it's a number of exposures. If you've only been exposed to 3 people, then you don't have this broad representation of what the possibilities are. Everybody wants to try to refine this into the simplest possible representation, that there can't be multiple influences that would make a structural appearance possible. It's just a matter of exposures. So you do get enough reps, whether we're talking about measuring a shoulder, whether we're talking about measuring a hip, or whether we're talking about an ISA measure, there's an element of experience that is required for you to get better and better and better at that, and then understanding more and more options. That aside, if you make an estimate on structure, a lot of this comes out in process. Because there are behavioral tendencies that are associated with the structure, right? And many of the interventions that you might use, you could use with both archetypes. What you have to understand is that the behavioral response would be different.
Yeah.
And then that helps guide your process. And so say you've identified somebody as a narrow ISA archetype, you just begin to intervene. And then very quickly, you'll start to recognize the fact that, okay, I'm not getting the effective change that I want, and it's not fulfilling the expectations based on my estimation of structure. You back up a little bit, and this is why we go through the chessboard construction, because it also provides measurement tendencies, right? And it also gives you the response. And so a lot of this stuff is worked out in process. And we could have the same conversation about, well, do I have an extremity situation that is influencing my inability to make a shape change proximally? The same thing is fleshed out in process, right? So it would be just like any other interference that we would see. I mean, we make estimations all the time that are incorrect. And so everybody wants to have the answer right away. And I understand the desire to do so. So you could be as correct as possible as you're moving through the process, but let the process sort of lead you in that respect and take a little bit of the pressure off yourself. Right. So it's like, it's okay. Cause everybody's going to make errors. Everybody's going to make mistakes. You're dealing with a dynamical system.
Right.
That many of your decisions are made after the intervention, because you don't know what the outcome is going to be regardless, even as accurate as you could possibly be, you still don't know how this person is going to behave. Right. And so this is why we have ongoing key performance indicators. This is why we construct chessboards. This is why we see the changes in the chessboards, is so we can follow what is this person doing? And then we get better and better at identifying the responses.
Right.
But again, there's an experiential element. It's like, it's not like this is a multiple choice test with the answer sitting right in front of you. It's like you literally have to do things, and then process fleshes out what you're actually working with.
Right. Because the whole assessment process isn't revolve around any single measurement.
That is correct.
And I think people make the mistake of really honing in on certain things, Trying to affect the ISA measure, or basing their entire series of interventions off of, well, this person's narrow, so my narrows get X, Y, and Z every time.
Right.
And that may work as long as you know that the assessment is showing you the behaviors that someone has that to manage gravity, Where they're at within their base of support, and where your starting point might be to reorganize them.
Right.
Or for them to reorganize themselves.
Yes.
And then what you're going to end up doing is just trying stuff. Pick the things that are the most safe to fail things, see the results that you're getting. And then if you keep trying to use all of these interventions that you used with narrows in the past that you think had the same sort of measurements or attributes as the person you're working on, and it's not working, then you just kind of go back and see where you might kind of poke holes in where you might be wrong.
And you touched on the fact that it's like there's no one single measurement that's going to give you enough information. And this is looking at the relationships, and then you look at the response, and then the response provides you clarity. Like every time you intervene, every response should give you clarity.
Yeah.
Right. But especially when you're first introduced to the influence of structure on behavior, it's a little overwhelming. And so it's easier to grasp onto,
right?
Like, oh, it's got to be this because this is the structure that I have decided that you are.
Yeah.
Right. Because like I said, you'll see changes. You start to resolve, compensatory strategies, and then there's greater and greater clarity.
Yeah.
And so people need to just trust process more so than a singular measurement, because all we're looking for is starting conditions. Like you take an initial chessboard, you do your complex movement assessment, you're looking for starting conditions in that circumstance. And we can't be perfect. So let the process flesh it.
Yeah. And a lot of times if someone's coming to see you as a practitioner, coach, clinician, whatever it might be, they're dealing with some sort of issue that involves a lot of compression and twisting. Mm-hmm. So if you have a bunch of people who are coming to you that are all very compressed, very twisted, and very far down this sort of compensatory path, you can do a lot of similar things in the beginning and see a result with both archetypes.
Absolutely.
And all configurations.
Absolutely.
Because a lot of it is going to be about alleviating compression, mm-hmm. delaying forward motion, trying to get people back into an earlier position, right. and then superimposing IR.
Yeah.
And along the way, as long as you're always checking in with your measurements that you can compare against, then you can course correct and
Absolutely.
Figure it out.
It's like the farther you get in process of reorganizing a system to where they would have, let's just say, the capacity for full relative motion if that person existed.
Yeah.
The closer and closer that we get to that full resolution, the more the structure becomes the primary influence, because the tendencies are much more specific at that point.
Right.
It's like I take any system and I compress it and I orient it. The orientations are going to follow at the extremes. You're going to see more similarities between the archetypes. As you resolve those, the archetype behaviors become much more expressed. And then that becomes infinitely more important. So whether you're right or whether you're wrong on structural archetype at the beginning, less concerning, to be honest with you.
Right.
But like I said, the closer and closer you get to resolution, now it becomes very important, but your structural tendencies are going to be more obvious. Like let's just take a narrow versus wide archetype at full relative motions, we start to drift the system. It's like that's where these representations of the two archetypes are most dissimilar. Mm-hmm. The farther you take somebody into compensatory strategies, the more similar they actually look, which is why you'll have people say, well, structure doesn't matter, right? Because I do this with no matter what their structure is, and I do really, really well. Great, because the further they are into that compensatory strategy, the more similar they will be.
Right.
But now you get a situation where I have a performance related issue, or I have a movement related issue that might be causing some sort of mechanical pain or something like that. And then as I resolve those strategies, I need to be much more clear because again, the tendencies are more specific.
Yeah. And you have to reorganize someone to allow the behavior that they ultimately want to,
Correct.
The activity they ultimately want to do to not happen the same way that it used to. So like, for instance, if you're talking about a person who recreationally skis and they always get anterior knee pain, and then after their trip, you're able to give them strategies and activities that alleviate symptoms, but every time they ski, they still get the knee pain. that there's a disconnect there where you're providing symptomatic relief, but you're not giving them the tools to reorganize themselves, right, and then allow for these sort of emergent things to happen when they're out on the ski slope.
Right.
Because they will always end up sort of reverting back to the path of least,
right,
resistance.
And then that's a good point. It's like, again, as I constrain the system more and more and more, it's like that pathway becomes much more narrowed regardless of your physical structure. And like,
right,
I said, they become very similar in that.
Yeah. So they just get all the compressions and the squeezes. So I think we should probably talk about some of the applied components of this and how to measure and what's important. Some of the things not to do, I think, are important to go over. I think a lot of times people go based off of visually what the ISA might look like, or throwing a goniometer on there and getting an angle, like a flat angle, and then saying, oh, you're wide, next person.
Right.
But, and we've talked about this in other places, it's on the network. There's a video of you kind of talking about ISA measurements as measuring behavior.
Right.
So maybe we talk a little bit about that. Like, what do you actually need to do to measure one with your hands, and what you're looking for, or like what you don't want to do, I think would be important as well.
Well, so number one, don't consider it a number.
Yeah.
We're looking at this as a behavior. And so when we think about like a normal inhalation versus exhalation, there's an external rotation that's associated with the breath in, there's an internal rotation associated with the breath out. And so this is reflected in the rib cage behavior. And so that's what, that's what we're actually monitoring for it. And so we're going to use hand contacts. And again, it's described in a couple of places on the network. It's like we're using hand contacts to help us sense what this behavior is. And so in a lot of situations, you don't get a lot of movement that's associated with the infrasternal angle. So number one, that gives you an element of understanding that, okay, this thing is constrained. Okay. And now I have to take into consideration, okay, so based on some of my other measurements, I have a system that has lost its adaptability. I don't have a lot of relative motion. So then my expectation is I'm going to lose relative motion in the ISA. But if you take like a typical narrow ISA archetype structure, and again, starting with full relative motions, and you think about the shape of that system, they have more anterior posterior expansion that would be associated with that structure. However, if this system starts to drift and the space within which they have to move is compressed, then the system becomes compressed as well. And so if I take somebody that has a big anterior posterior dimension and I compress them anterior to posterior, they start to spread out sideways. And so if I put pressure on the sternum and that superior aspect of the infrasternal angle, the infrasternal angle gets pushed away towards midline, towards ER, which creates some of the confusion between wide and narrow ISAs.
Right.
Right. I could have a torsion that's occurring within the rib cage itself. And then that makes it look like an asymmetrical representation of an ISA. That's representative of this turn, versus somebody that would create confusion and go, well, they're wide on one side and narrow on the other, which is really not going to be the case. Right. So again, this is partially experiential to understand. It's like I am applying constraints to the system that's going to affect our perception of what this measurement is. But we're looking as behavior. So we want to see this natural external rotation of the infrasternal angle, internal rotation of the infrasternal angle during a normal breath. That would be our representation of somebody that has greater access to relative motions. At any point it's constrained, you're starting there. You go, okay, at least I know that this system doesn't have full access to relative motion, whether I've identified them and skewed them towards the narrow archetype or the wide archetype, at least I know it's constrained. As I reduce any of these constraints, I'm going to get more information. I can go back to that measure now, and I can start to see if it has affected the capacity of the diaphragm to move, really,
right,
is what we're talking about, right? And that would be represented in the recapture of the internal and external rotation behavior of the ISA.
Yeah.
But people just have to understand, it's like if you've only done this a few times, it's like you just don't have a strong grasp of what the potentials are. And that comes with more time.
Yeah, I think important to note, you can't really measure it on yourself. So there's no point in trying to like put your fingers on your ribs and then breathe and trying to figure out what's going on there. But just in terms of process of doing the test, and we're sort of imagining like putting hands on a rib cage, using thumbs to sort of approximate an angle.
Right.
And then what you were mentioning is what, trying to get this sort of ER out and away expansion, right. And it then was, falling so, inward right. and down.
It towards, just expands. It expands away from midline, and then it compresses towards midline.
Right. Yeah. So, and then the things that you're going to see that are not that would be both my hands sort of picking up and coming down, both my hands getting wide
right.
and then coming back in, or maybe both my hands sort of elevating as they shrug.
Yeah. And so when you, this is one of the reasons why we constrain the test the way that we do with the upper extremities, because what we're doing is we're putting the thorax in a position where there's actually a transition towards inhalation versus exhalation, which right. which would then, again, if I have a constrained ISA in any circumstance and I put them at this transition, the system really has to make a decision based on capabilities as to how it's going to take air in.
Yeah, and you're and you're talking about someone laying on their back, reaching towards the ceiling, and letting their hands kind of drift into an overhead position uh-huh. until their thorax wants to roll back.
Right, because that would naturally occur.
Yeah.
Right, and especially in a system that does have constraints that are limiting relative motions, mm-hmm. right? And so that allows us to magnify this behavior in one direction or the other, right? And that's why it's so important to do this, because if you're just and there are situations where you could literally just put somebody on the treatment table and you can lay your hands, you go, there's no way this person is ever going to be remotely recognized as a narrow ISA, but we want to create the constraint that biases this into a stronger direction. It makes it a whole lot easier to identify, mm-hmm. which is why, and again, that's why I constructed the test the way I did.
Right.
You know, because there is a lack of clarity in people based on the magnitude of muscle activity that's constraining the relative motion.
Okay. So it's kind of talked about the position and taking measurements, and then you had mentioned a little bit like asymmetrical presentations. Mm-hmm. It's not that someone is like half wide, half narrow.
Correct.
So maybe talk about like straight and bent ribs.
Yeah. So if you think about just a foundational narrow archetype, and we talk about rib cage shape, because of the compensatory breathing strategy that's associated with that archetype, their ribs are actually in a straighter representation, which again, that lends itself to sort of the appearance of the greater depth of the thorax, A to P.
Right.
And then if you think about on the other end of the spectrum, foundational wide ISA archetype, because of the compensatory inhalation that they're associated with, they have more of the ER shape. So the ribs have much more curve to it. And so that lends it to the fact that they're a little bit more AP compressed. And so they're going to be represented a little bit wider relative to. Mm-hmm. And so if we looked at ribs on a narrow, they will tend to be straight, and I can point my fingers at the camera here. So if I straighten the ribs, it sort of narrows the infrasternal angle. And then if I bend the ribs, it moves out and away from midline into that ER position. And then that's part of the constraint that actually biases somebody's structure. Well, it's biased by their structure.
Right.
And that we'll see the more of the ER rib cage shape in the wide, and we're going to see more of the IR rib cage shape in the near.
Okay. And then as I'm testing, so as I put my hands on someone's rib cage and I ask them to breathe, what are the things that are going to tell me if I have a narrow that I'm measuring or a wide? Like, what are the main things?
Well, I'm putting the upper extremity at this transition point, right?
Sure.
And so if they take a breath in, it should allow the anterior aspect of the thorax to expand, and that would turn the rib cage up and away from midline, which would be our ER representation, and yeah. as they exhale, it would turn towards, right? If I have the narrow that's constrained in IR, they take their breath in, I'm going to get maybe some superior inferior movement, but essentially you're not going to see this anterior posterior expansion. So the ribs don't turn away from midline into ER. You're going to see that IR biased rib cage that's going to keep those ribs straight. And so they remain narrow.
Okay. And then your narrows are going that, or your wides are going to get wider, but they're going to have a hard time going
they
back.
Don't, yeah. So again, you're following the exhalation, and it's like, okay, so they just can't express that IR representation of the rib cage because their bias is away from midline because it's a compensatory inhalation.
Yeah. So it would, so a narrow, would you say a narrow might get, with measuring a narrow, they might be able to get smaller at the ISA, but not get any larger?
That would be the direction of the constraint.
That would be the direction. Yeah. Of it. And then a wide is going to be able to get wider, but not really be able to close.
And that would, that, and again, yeah, there's your bias.
Okay.
There's your bias.
Yeah. So that's, sure, that's helpful, I think. And then I think other, so maybe a couple of other things that can be used as confirmation, like some visual things, some behavioral things. You know, we, you talk about the expansion bias of a narrow, mm-hmm, would allow for typically larger ranges of motion.
A greater excursion of external
rotation. Greater excursion of external rotation.
Yeah, for sure.
Just in terms of someone coming in that has always been flexible, their whole flexible, like they can, uh-huh, touch their toes. They have, yeah, no issue with, yeah, like stretch. Nothing seems to feel like it needs, yeah, to be stretched on,
yeah,
them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, people who are more prone to like endurance activities, rotational activities, they have a history of playing tennis or distance running. Uh-huh. Versus someone who has never been the greatest at touching their toes or being flexible. They didn't do very well on the toe touch presidential fitness test. I yeah.
The sit and reach.
Yeah, that was my best. That was my best event. So that kind of lending itself to you choosing,
yeah,
or confirming whether what you're looking at, yeah, is wide,
so,
or narrow.
Think about this for a sec. So the natural tendency of a narrow ISA archetype would be biased towards greater external rotation,
yeah,
capabilities in the first place. Anterior-posterior compression is going to project that external rotation further and further away from midline,
right,
which can account for some of the so-called increased flexibility that would be represented. You also see bigger ER compensations in that circumstance as well. Which would again magnify. So these are pick on yoga practitioners because it's an easy representation to see. It's like these are the people that come in and you ask them to do a toe touch test and they palm the floor.
Yeah.
Right. And then you see the ER compensatory strategies much more represented, especially in spine in a lot of cases. And so that's might be one of the reasons why they gravitate towards those types of activities is because they're sort of good at them.
Yeah.
Right. There's a lot of postures and positions that they would use in yoga that have a very strong ER bias.
Right.
And if I have a wide archetype structure that doesn't really have access to those positions to begin with, while I can have orientation that's going to move me towards ER, my IR bias sort of constrains me from having the most significant demonstrations, right? It's pretty rare to see, like, take somebody at the strong end of the wide ISA bias. It's very rare that you would see somebody like that, like, accused of being hypermobile,
right?
Right, or have extreme levels of flexibility. I'm not saying it's not possible. I'm just saying it's like it's going to require a lot more external rotation orientation of the system to be able to accomplish something like that.
Yeah, and your wides are typically going to be stronger at putting force.
Yeah, that's their gift, right? It's just higher force structure. But again, the greater the force production, the more likely you are to constrain the external rotation space.
Right.
Right. I'm better at pushing down than making space to move. It's like, so that's going to kick you towards that wide ISA bias.
Yeah. And your narrows are always going to have sort of a, not always, but they will tend to have more of like a long, wangy looking frame.
Yeah. It's a narrower tube, right?
Yeah.
It's like, so you look at that structure.
They don't carry muscle as well. Even if they do, it's kind of like a softer look.
They'll like a narrow ISA that can put on a lot of muscle. You're going to have to take into configuration in that circumstance, which gives them some capacity to produce force, just because of the differential in pressure within the structure itself.
Yeah,
it's like if you take a, you know, somebody with like a marathon runner type of a structure that wouldn't have like a big differential through the thorax. Like you take somebody with a narrow ISA, but they've got a wider thorax superiorly than inferiorly. That actually is a narrow that can produce a decent amount of pressure. And so they can usually put on a lot of muscle.
And they can look wide on a table if you don't.
Well, because then you're going to add the AP compression onto that. And so then that gives them
which will bend the ribs into a position
that's much more of the mechanical element associated with the increased intramuscular pressure associated with carrying a lot of muscle.
Right. And that might be a good point to I think some people are still trying to change a wide to a narrow, but I think it's, and that isn't what you just mentioned is not a narrow turning themselves into a wide.
Correct.
And maybe explain why that is, because you measure it, it looks wide, but what inherently about the narrow is never going to let them act as a wide, behave as a wide?
So a lot of it has to do with the capture of the capacity to push straight down into the ground.
Yeah.
Right. So they're always going to have these biases. Like if you were to look at like a squat, like a deep squat test, it kind of reveals itself there.
Right.
Because the even though they could squat below parallel, you're going to see some of the pelvic bias. It's not going to allow you to sort of rest directly on your heels unless you have added some compensatory strategy away from midline to make more space. So think about like a wide ISA, and they orient the extremities away from midline into ER, and then that's how they compensate to access the deep squat. Doesn't make it wrong. It just means like, okay, my structure says I need to orient these extremities away from midline. Otherwise I can't sit down because my bias is to push myself away from the ground as a high force producer. And so what do you do there? Well, if I orient the extremities away from ER, I have reduced my capacity to push down in the ground, but I've also given myself some space. And so that allows that descent to occur. And so you can, and again, this goes back to the fact that, okay, I have these structural tendencies that I will use to access certain shapes and positions, because the rules go to the deep squat. The rule for the deep squat is I have to have enough ER space, and I have to be able to superimpose enough IR at the bottom. Just enough at the bottom, right? And so if I have a structure that says, well, you're going to be IR biased, well, I just add the compensation, and then my squat would look, for many cases, acceptable as a squat.
Right. Yeah. So I think we kind of touched on the important takeaways are
don't be paralyzed.
Yeah. Don't be paralyzed by your ISA measure. Shouldn't care that much, even if 5 years into training someone, you find out you were wrong. Because if you've managed to help that person, or you've managed to intervene and help others who maybe you thought a bunch of compressed narrows were wides and you trained them like wides and they all got better and they didn't have their symptoms anymore, then you did the right stuff.
They're still human.
Yeah. They're going to adapt. It's just now you have like a little bit, you have a better way to kind of refine your process. And then also it helps people to understand why some things don't work.
Yeah.
Because you settled on a diagnosis, or you would address this thing and you say, okay, well, that person's a narrow, like this stuff isn't working, but you didn't ask the question or look at your measures and say, where could I possibly messed up here?
Remember my first slide from the assessment course is like, the goal is to be an adaptable practitioner.
Yeah.
Right. Because we know we're going to make mistakes. We know we're going to make errors in judgment because we're an adaptive system. The client's an adaptive system. And so it's always going to be challenging and difficult. And that's why we rely on process. Right. Not a singular moment or a singular test.
Right. And then in terms of getting into like interventions and stuff, we've filmed several episodes about training wides, training narrows, tendencies for each. So I would suggest people go back to watch those. But we wanted to just sort of clarify, let everyone know that it's okay. That if they don't understand how to measure ISAs, or they've measured their ISAs wrong, or they've been living this life of a wide ISA and now they found out they're narrow and their whole world has been flipped upside down, it doesn't really matter that much.
It doesn't make you a bad person.
Yeah.